Essay 9. It rained almost all morning today, a warm, stuffy, dank rain. The leaves still up must be hooked on strongly enough to stand it. They droop but do not fall. Such lovely flat lobes just hanging there. I stop and start on my walk, trying to really look at, connect with some of the trees I pass, looking to give and take, well, love, you might say. I stop below a beautiful small maple. Look at it. Its answer is clear. Please don't look at me today. I want to be alone. Gave no reason, just this honest, very politely stated request. I respected that and moved on. About a half mile down the path, I encountered another tree, similar, small, that reached back to me so charmingly, so happily. Not like it was just waiting for me, but delighted to see me and connect with me. I stayed there with it for a while, happy with it. This is the kind of love I want to think about today, the kind that says generously, respectfully, both yes to no and yes to yes. A few days ago at work, I reread H.D.'s Notes on Thought and Vision, such a unique, inspiring exploration of her notion of the creative process, orchestrated through an array of fully female, not feminine, not feminist, female figures. The first of its kind, as far as I know, and still the best, concocted at an historical moment generally and a life moment for her that made the likelihood of producing such a treatise infinitesimally small. She actually grounds her metaphoric grid so interestingly, so surprisingly, in the female body, brain connected to womb, by establishing the figure of the jellyfish at the center of her system, and then elaborating its implications. It would be 50 years before vagina, uterus, became commonplace terms in discussions of female creativity. They are not words H.D. uses here in 1919, preferring the very tame, by our standards, love regions. But she might as well have. It's that clear, to me at least, that they are included and implied in the way mind connects to body, via the jellyfish. She talks a lot about this jellyfish business early in the book, so provocatively, engagingly. But it's halfway through the book before she fully shows her hand in her translation of male to female, and she does it in two succinct sentences. The world of vision has been symbolized in all ages by various priestly cults in all countries by the serpent. In my personal language or vision, I call this serpent a jellyfish. I laughed out loud when I read this passage this time. It's brilliant. How do you get a jellyfish from a serpent? Who makes that move? Well, she did. And if you think about it figuratively rather than physically, it makes perfect sense. One is a penis, the other is a womb. All of a sudden, along the central figurative axis that organizes what poetry is, what creation is, what thinking and feeling are, a woman's body is at the core and a man's is not. H.D.'s whole career, a dramatic reordering of Western myth, Helen in Egypt, religion, trilogy, poetics, hermetic definition, that installs female figures in the positions that have been held down by male figures for as long as anyone could remember, is just a footnote to this little slip of the tongue in Notes. You say serpent, I say jellyfish. Let's call the whole thing off. And in my little thought experiment, the same one I used to get Emily Dickinson, I could see that if history had been gender reversed, and I was stuck in the Scilly Islands in 1919 trying to get my life together, wanting to be a player in the world of poetry, I would have to do what she did. See a sea full of jellyfish contracting orgasmically around me and think, well, how about a serpent instead? Brilliant. This is a book almost no one reads. I don't think I've ever run across anyone who had read it before I taught it. As is the case with H.D.'s work generally, that staggering and magnificent body of work produced over her lifetime, clearly, to me, equal in innovation, scope, and eloquence with anyone in the top tier of male poets from her generation, Eliot, Williams, Pound, Stevens, any of them. As the magnitude of her accomplishment became more and more evident to me over the years, just through more and more exposure to her work, I started wondering why I hadn't been apprised of her status when I was in college, reading all of those modernist master poets in my first survey course. So I went back to the Norton Anthology. I used that term. I have no idea why I still have it, but I do. This iconic compilation, the gold standard for surveys back then, 3 inches thick, containing a little bit of everyone and a lot from all the big boys. I wanted to see what part of HD's work was there. Well, it wasn't. None of it. Nothing. I couldn't believe it. And now, further, why don't we read this little book I was reading? We read Eliot's The Sacred Wood, all of those short, sharp, blockbuster essays, and William's Spring and All, every bit as eccentric, serendipitous, outlandish as H.D.'s little book, tuned to a masculine register of tropes. But not Notes on Thought and Vision. I was thinking on my walk today about how liberating it is as a man to have to think through the opposite set of figures, imagine how, if at all, my creative enterprise might or might not be channeled through a womb, imagining that I am trying to write my way into a tradition that has been owned by women for millennia. What would I do? I might, of course, say, well, I don't have a womb, so this doesn't apply to me. I guess I'll do something else. That is the exact conundrum out of which women creators have needed to emerge if they had any hope of being writers well into the 20th century. All of the defenses, approaches, systems rendered unreflexively through a figurative web that was masculine, patriarchal, or just plain phallic. My synecdochic example being the one I used in an earlier essay, that sword of lightning ever unsheathed which consumes the scabbard that will contain it. Again, yikes. Women could easily have said, as I'm supposing many did, well, this says I have to have a white-hot dick to do it, and I don't, so I can't. But many didn't say that. So what did they do? That I now have to do, as I sit here and read this remarkable little book, me, Dr. Old White Male, the exact one who should be most readily precluded from this womb-based model of creation. That's what I was thinking about today, riffing out, as I often do on these walks, some of the things I might want to say about it in class, animated, hands flashing around dramatically, my manifesto performative mode, most of which I hope will winnow down to something more manageable by 2 p.m. tomorrow. I won't go into all of that, or in class tomorrow, most likely, but I had a lot of fun thinking about it. I actually read the book kind of backwards this time, as I often do when I reread, starting somewhere in medias res that attracts me, reassembling things piecemeal back and forth in and out until I'm done. The section I ended up centered on this time was her description of the Chinese poet Lo Fu's intimate relationship with a tree branch, which he first notices, then approaches, then gets so engrossed in, detail after detail, deep and deeper, that it becomes his mistress, accompanying him back to his room, where he meditates caressingly on the memory until it comes even more fully to life, present in its absence. It starts out this way. Lo Fu sat in his orchard and looked in a vague, casual way. Against the gray stones of the orchard wall, he saw a low branch of an apple tree. He thought, that shoot should have been pruned. It hangs too low. Then, as he looked at the straight, tough, young shoot, he thought, no, the apples are excellent, so round and firm. Then he went on looking. You see Lo Fu's shift here from a vague to a clear way of looking. As she says a little later, his conscious mind ceased wondering, and being an artist, his intensity and concentration were of a special order. He then uses these powers to study the branch in the most intense and exotic ways until the leaves were continents with rivers and many, many little fields. It is an astonishing process, almost timeless, of falling in love. as a result of which he really did look at, he really did see it, she says. Then he goes to his room where his love, his apple branch, his beautiful, subtle mistress was his, and having possessed her with his great soul, she was his forever. Such a beautiful set of observations, both his and hers. But to me, it ends puzzlingly, unsettlingly, disturbingly even, with the word possessed. That word just stuck in my craw, and it's still stuck there. I've been rereading notes, and especially this section, over and over, trying to find my way out of my discomfort. All of this beautiful, gentle loving between Lo Fu and his branch reduced, finally, to possession, ownership. Why? At first, because Lo Fu is figured male, I thought H.D. might simply be saying that that is the only possible outcome for a man, whether for cultural or biological reasons. It's just what men always end up doing with what they love. This was heartbreakingly depressing to me. I could not accept that. Then I remembered the note at the end of the book in which it is made clear that the real Lo Fu was, in fact, a woman. I was relieved, seizing on this as a way out of my depressing gender trap. But that, of course, only generalizes the problem. It doesn't solve it. So I kept rereading, trying to figure it, to refigure it, literally. Here's what I came to. H.D. had been writing about a certain kind of love from early in the book, exactly the kind I have in mind these days when I think about my relationship with these trees, with the things that make up the world around us in general. Throughout, I hear H.D. arguing that poetry arises from and derives from our falling in love with things. I couldn't agree more. I started thinking about this sort of experience in a conscious way almost 50 years ago, walking down an empty street in Scranton, Pennsylvania, a rainy gray afternoon, something of consequence on my mind, though I cannot recall what that might have been. I will say now I was depressed, though that might go without saying if you ever walked down an empty street in Scranton in the late 1960s. The northeastern Pennsylvania I grew up in was always characterized back then as a depressed area. I was in college before I realized that the term was being used economically rather than psychologically. So I'm walking distractedly, head down, and I pass over a manhole cover. For some reason, I noticed some faded patches and flecks of red and green paint all over it. I calculated unconsciously that at some point, many decades previously, when it was new, it must have been painted flamboyantly in those colors, more a work of art than a sewer lid. And suddenly, I was stunned out of my inattention. I gazed at the manhole cover. I could not take my eyes off it. I literally fell in love with it, what it had been, what it was now, both so beautiful. I was enthralled. I don't know how long I stood there. I can see that manhole cover in my mind's eye right now. Stunning. I don't recall exactly, but I'm quite sure that whatever had been afflicting me right then was gone. That I was not depressed, but ecstatic, how anyone feels when they fall in love. I didn't think much about this experience until maybe a decade later, when I was at a point where I knew I was going to need credentials, publications to get and keep the job. I decided to write something about the value, the real value of poetry for me, how it was more an approach toward the world, things, objects, people, everything, than a body of texts or a series of words. I called this piece Thinking Poetry. Somewhere in it, I made reference to this falling in love business and used my encounter with the manhole cover as an example. I got the piece published in a small journal that had teaching or teachers in its title. I don't have the piece, so I can't check. Well, you might say, check your CV. But here's what happened with that. I got my first full-time job at a relatively elite college in 1977. I knew I would have to publish and present my publications for others to evaluate if I intended to sustain my position there. I had this warm, thinking poetry going in, but after a while I started to think what the reaction among my senior colleagues would be to this upstart who had a habit of falling in love with manhole covers. Not good, not good at all. You might say, well, maybe not. No, I knew these people. Not good. So I removed the line from my CV entirely. No one but me would ever know what I really thought about thinking poetry. I laugh now, remembering all of that. I got terminated. What a great word. So antiseptic and incendiary all at the same time. There, anyhow, for being, well, that's beside the point. It is, though, looking back from here, the moment in my career for which I am most proud. I stood up for something, and at least no one involved in that process ever got to say it was because I fell in love with manhole covers. In any case, I have fallen in love with things, almost any category of thing you can think of, thousands of times in the interim, as I have with all the trees I meet on my daily walks. I've never regretted one of them. This is what gets me back to possession. The thing about things is you cannot both love and possess them. They are where they are. You can return to them, but they never belong to you. And here's the other thing, which I have realized in a deep way only on my walks this fall, all these trees reaching out to me. Many of the things you fall in love with love you back. Really, truly, the best kind of love. Not all of them, of course. You can tell which way it's going to go if you pay attention. I believe, in retrospect, that the manhole cover I fell in love with also fell in love with me. I think it will never forget the day that guy fell in love with it. It has a good story to tell, too. This sort of experience, these kind of intimate relationships, are hard to account for, almost impossible to explain, in the context of postmodernist critical and philosophical systems. If you know something about them, you'll know exactly what I mean. If you don't bother checking, believe me. That's part of why I took that article off my CV. But they are not as hard to account for in the context of the now emergent object-oriented ontology movement. At the extreme, maybe, but possible. Again, if you read that work, I think you'll see how and why that's true. If you don't worry about it. If you really want to know what I mean, read poetry, good poetry. Read H.D. She fell in love with things all the time. If you read enough of that, you will find yourself doing it without having had to read philosophy to learn how or explain why. Very early in Notes, H.D. introduces the theme of love via a reference to Socrates' famous second speech in the Phaedrus, when she refers to his way of orchestrating vision and love. Socrates' whole doctrine of vision was a doctrine of love. We must be in love before we can understand the mysteries of vision. If you read his speech, true love actually changes how we see or look at the beloved, and our eyes are only open this way if we are filled from without by a godly madness, are possessed in that way, outside in. Everyone knows what such loving eyes look like in everyday terms. You don't have to read Plato or H.D. to know that. We have all witnessed them and displayed them at some point. For example, when Bridget was in elementary school, either Carol or I would pick her up after school so she wouldn't have to sit on a bus. Whenever possible, even if Carol was going to do that, which was most days, I'd go too. Seems like overkill, I know. Two parents with two cars to drive one kid 2 miles. But here's the thing. I did it because I couldn't wait to set eyes on her. And I truly believed that she couldn't wait to set eyes on me and Carol. Parents had to wait for these pickups about 100 feet in front of the school, beside a flagpole, a small and devoted band of us who got to know one another there over time. When school let out, hundreds of kids from all grades would flood out to find buses or meet parents. I would have my eyes trained on this sea of faces, and as soon as Bridget came out the door, hers would be the only face I could see. It would fill up the universe with a bright light. Her eyes would be trained toward the flagpole, and as soon as she saw us, her eyes would light up like the sun. You might say, how could anyone see that from 100 feet away? Well, that is exactly what loving eyes can and will do. HD talks about some of the things her eyes love. She says, the Delphic charioteer has, I have said, an almost hypnotic effect upon me. The bend of his arm, the knife cut of his chin, his feet, rather flat, slightly separated, a firm pedestal for himself, the fall of his drapery in geometrical precision, and the angles of the ingatherings of the drapery at the waist. Just a statue, but the most minuscule details of it, so vividly observed, rendered, enlivened by her loving eyes. Da Vinci, she goes on to say, went mad if he saw a boy's face in Florence, or a caged bird, or a child with yellow hair that fell or stood up in tight whorls like the goldsmith work he had learned with Verrocchio. And Jesus, whom she calls the Galilean here and elsewhere, loves this way as well. She says, the Galilean fell in love with things as well as people. He would fall in love with a seagull or some lake heron that would dart up from the coarse lake grass when Peter leapt out to drag his great boat on shore. Or the plain little speckled backs of the birds bought in the market by the poor Jews. He looked at the blue grass lily and the red-brown sand lily that grew under the sheltered hot sandbanks in the southern winter for hours and hours. If he closed his eyes, he saw every vein and fleck of blue or vermilion. If you want to know exactly what I mean by falling in love with things, well, here it is. I am not Jesus, to be sure. But this capacity of his is, I am sure, while it may begin with a godly possession, fully human, it is, I would say, what makes and keeps us human, ensconced intimately in a material world so vivid, so enchanting. Why would we not take as much advantage of it as we can before we are marched off to a heaven or a hell, or a nowhere that is spectral, disembodied, dull, dull, dull by comparison. For HD, this kind of love is the only way we can save our life here. She says, there are two ways of escaping the pain and despair of life, and of the rarest, most subtle, dangerous, and ensnaring gift that life can bring us, love. One way is to kill that love in one's heart. To kill love, to kill life. The other way is to accept that love, to accept the snare, to accept the pricks, the thistles, to accept life. But that is dangerous. It is also dangerous not to accept life. So I am back to Lo Fu, and I've answered my question, relieved my troubledness with the concept of possession. The kind of love HD, Lo Fu, the Galilean, Socrates, and I are talking about is not ownership, domination, control. It is a being taken over, enthralled from the outside in by a godly madness that is only possible on a physical plane, this earth we need to stay at, for whatever reason, for whatever time we're told. I know. In the sentence where that word appears, this meaning of possession is syntactically impossible. But I also know that if I could have a conversation with HD about this, she would say, oh, yes, I see. That's what I actually meant. Let me change that right now. I may be rewriting history here, but isn't that exactly what H.D. is doing when she calls a serpent a jellyfish? What she would want all of us to do when we find ourselves closed off for some reason from what's truly good and true in the reality we have to live in. Rewrite it. Right now.